I remember 4 years ago, I gave a talk about thermoplastic, and everybody was excited, but they were also skeptical whether this will work and also whether it will be approved. And there were a lot of questions about the mechanism of action of thermoplastic. I can tell you after 4 years, it has been approved, but there are questions about the mechanism and the selection is still unclear to me. Now, is that the reason why you didn't buy a thermoplastic machine? I was thinking that the Lebanese will buy it the first, because I know you are trendy people and you always buy the new things, but I learned yesterday from the Dean of Medicine here that you don't have thermoplastic. Maybe I don't blame you. Okay, so you have heard the last 2 days about, you know, personalized medicine, whatever you want to call it. And now we are moving, you have seen in the first presentation, reality and current treatment, trying to move you to the future and some fantasy. That we are moving to an era where we would like to phenotype our patients and give them the right treatment. I think there's enough, at least in asthma I speak, of a lot of drugs were used for the wrong patients. And that's why in the last few years we have been working into phenotyping our patients. So before I go there, I put this question for you. I just put it actually 10 minutes before we start. We spoke about phenotype. So the following are different phenotype of asthma except eosinophilic, neutrophilic, non-inflammatory with smooth muscle mass, fibrotic, and lymphocytic. So who will go for eosinophilic, neutrophilic? It's correct? No, non-inflammatory? Can asthma be non-inflammatory? Fibrotic? Lymphocytic. Okay. So this is the current sort of phenotype of asthma that we really have confirmed in a number of studies, that there's an inflammatory and non-inflammatory, and the inflammatory go into the IgE, eosinophilic high, neutrophilic high, you heard about it yesterday. The remodeling one, in response to injury, what we usually have, the tissue would try to repair itself, and we got either a smooth muscle hyperplasia or fibrotic response. And that's what we call the non-inflammatory. Now, in the last also few years, there's been a lot of biological, and you hear they gave a talk, and Nicola Hanini gave a talk about biological. And people are excited about biologicals, and IL-5, and IL-13, and IL-4. So if you calculate that all the biologicals, if we got the severe asthma individual, which are about 25 to 30% of the populations, and put them into this criteria, what is the percentage of severe asthma that do not fit the criteria for all the current sort of biological of severe asthma? 40%, 10%, 3%, 90%, 60%. So who will go for 40%? 10%, 3%, 9%, and 60%. So 60% of those patients do not fit the criteria for the biological. So what does that mean? It means that we have 60% of the 30% of the severe asthma, they need a new treatment. They need, because the other one we phenotype in, those ones should be another phenotype that they will need the new treatment. So to go back, one has to go to the basic histology of the lung, and see that the lung is not only inflammation there and shedding of the epithelium, but there is increase in the smooth muscle mass. And this smooth muscle mass correlates with the pulmonary function. I train with a guy called Peter Macklem. Lubna know him, and Dr. Lewis know him. He told me if there's no smooth muscle, there's no asthma. So those smooth muscle, but none of these drugs will affect the smooth muscle. Now, the other thing is that, okay, I think we're missing some slide. So to get He put the wrong things. Anyway, so this, to get these smooth muscle out, people have tried medications. They use a statin to induce them to get into the sort of apoptosis. But the idea did not work, and the clinical trial was a failure. So people were trying to think to remove them. You cannot remove them surgically by endoscopy, to kill them, but without inducing any necrosis. And the way that is to heat them, آخر الدواء الكي, but not burn them. And that was the idea of the thermoplasty. So the radio frequency that is applying thermoplasty is inducing, that's the idea. And I can tell you that we did 4 clinical trials without a proof. There's 1 proof on dogs. And then until it has been FDA approved, there was no biopsy study for all these 4 clinical trials. So they did a simple experiment on a dog, and they treat the dog bronchi, and they show that the smooth muscle is removed. They say, okay, this is the proof of concepts. And they went and they produce what we call the thermoplasty procedure, which, how many of you attended the workshop this morning? Only a few. So for people who are not familiar with this, can we get this video to work? I think you remove some of the slides, sir. You put the wrong one. I told you that. Anyway, so the idea of the thermoplasty is to get the force of a catheter with a basket, and that basket will open and touch the airway wall, and you produce the radio frequency there, and that radio frequency you can do it, you can pass it through the third of the lung in each session for 1 hour, 3 sessions, 3 weeks intervals. And that radio frequency will basically induce the changes or the supposed changes in the airways. So we do the right lower lobe, the right lower, left lower lobe, upper lobe, but we do not touch, at least in our center, the middle lobe, and then each one will be 1 hour. Now, the procedure was approved, coming to why we need to phenotype our patients. The procedure was approved by 4 clinical trials. It's called Feasibility, AIR, RESA, and AIR-2. And those ones, actually, none of them were associated with biopsy procedure. And they produced the result, the criteria of the patients are not really real phenotypes. Those patients who do not respond to steroid, they are on high dose of steroid, they put them on this treatment, and they show us the result that it is really decreasing exacerbation. But if you look at them, there's a good percentage of them, they do not respond well. And also, even the placebo was working there. So it seems that among those population, there's certain population who respond better than other populations. And all the results were really shown as those bars. And when you see those bar, do you see the standard deviation? You know there is a good number of this group who are not responding, but they have been receiving this procedure, which costs almost $10,000, and it's not an easy procedure. So the question here, do we need to do biopsy before thermoplasty? That's the question was raised. Do we need to see an increase in, if it is increased smooth muscle? We have to identify this phenotype before we do these biopsies. So do we need to do that? Who will say yes? Who will say no? Who will say I don't know? I think I don't know. Okay. So this is the first sort of case report was reported that this patient received thermoplasty and then improved, but there's still the smooth muscle is there. So the idea that it removed the smooth muscle entirely was not true in this case report. Now, so it is only acting on smooth muscle? Do you think it acting on collagen? Do you think it act on neurons? Do you think it act on inflammatory markers? Who would think that it might act on collagen, not only smooth muscle?
I don't know.
I don't know. But we know some of these, you're going to see. Do you think it's work on smooth muscle, collagen? Do you think it work on neurons, yeah. nerves? Do you think it work on nitric oxide and inflammatory markers? We're going to see. So this is a study by Jamila Shakir, one of my fellows before. And she went there and they did not company sponsor study. And they look at this sort of biopsy before and after and look into things. And if you look to the next slide here, you can see that those biopsy before and after, some of them, the smooth muscle disappear very significantly. The other one did not appear to decrease significantly. So the idea that we remove all the smooth muscle, this is by Michel Laviolette, who's one of the best bronchoscopists. He did it there, and in all these large number of patients, there's a group of patients that the smooth muscle did not go down. The other one, they went down there. But what she showed in this, in her experiment, is that the subepithelial fibrosis decreased. So here we are adding another thing, another mechanism to the thermoplasty. And if that is true, we are really solving a big problem because we do not have any drugs to affect the subepithelial fibrosis. The fibrotic phenotypes, if the patient reached, this is a very advanced case of fibrotic phenotype, if we reach to this stage, patients are usually very difficult to treat, but if we can prevent or reduce the subepithelial fibrosis, I think we have done a good job. So now we are adding to the smooth muscle the subepithelial fibrosis. Does thermoplasty affect the nerves? You know, people who are old as mine, as me, in the 80s we are speaking as a substance P, VIP, and nerve there. And then this sort of fashion disappeared there, but still, you know, you need the nerves to get all the constriction, you need the nerve to get all the sensation of the airways. And the idea was here, when we are burning this, why should only the smooth muscle, are we affecting the nerve? And we did recently, we just completed a big study where we phenotype, I'm going to speak to you in a minute. What we do the biopsies and then phenotype those patients and then perform thermoplasty on high smooth muscle, low smooth muscle one. And here we double stain for smooth muscle and for nerves. And if it is clear there to you, I don't know if it's clear, but you can see there that this red is the smooth muscle. In this case, disappeared completely. In this one here, there's a lot of smooth muscle. But what has disappeared completely are a lot of the substance P and VIP innervation. And also, Michel Aubry in France showed that there is a decrease in the neuroendocrine cells. So here we are adding another sort of parameter to the effect of thermoplasty. And the company idea that everything will work, everything the smooth muscle will go, is not true. They will not like me for that. And I think that we have to open our mind that thermoplasty is affecting other parameters. Now, some of those patients have a big trunks of nerves. Those are very high pontification there. And when you do the thermoplasty, all these big trunks of nerve, they disappear. And we went back to them after 6 months, and they do not appear again. Now, asthma is in inflammatory. Most of those patients that they did are in inflammatory because they didn't phenotype the non-inflammatories. So we asked the question, does thermoplasty affect inflammatory cells and inflammatory markers? And we chose eosinophils, neutrophils, nitric oxide, epithelial cells. So the question here is, does thermoplasty affect eosinophil, neutrophils, nitric oxide, epithelial, and or none of the above? Who will go for eosinophils? For neutrophils? For nitric oxide? For epithelial cells? None of the above? Okay. In fact, thermoplasts did not affect any of the inflammatory markers or none of the sort of epithelial cells rather than nitric oxide. So it seems that thermoplasty is really affecting asthmatic who have structural changes, which are mostly smooth muscle, yes, but also people who have a lot of subepithelial fibrosis and people with nerve, a lot of innervation and hyperplasia of what we call of neuroendocrine cells. So the question is, do we need to phenotype? Do we need to do a biopsy for each one? Now, it is difficult, but I think we have to do that because otherwise we will expose 60% of our severe asthmatic to thermoplasty without any effect, which might cause damage, actually more damage to those patients. And we are now, and other group, are looking for non-invasive markers for smooth muscle hyperplasia and subepithelial fibrosis and increase in innervation. Thank you very much.
I guess we can open the floor for a couple of questions. Dr. Givelikian.
Thank you, Professor, for a disturbing presentation.
What?
How does it work? So I have a couple of questions. One of them relates to simple geography, if you will. Thermoplasty, how far does it reach? I mean, we've been preaching and have been preached about small airways and, you know, 2 millimeters and whatever and small particles. And here you have a scope that is, what, 6 millimeters, 8 millimeters?
It reached to up to 4 millimeters.
4 millimeters, great. Millimeters. So 4 millimeters, yeah. How deep does it affect? Maybe you're targeting the wrong caliber airways. I don't know. Yeah. Is that something that the biopsy might show? And then the other question is in terms of targeting patients, since we're talking about smooth muscles and the innervation, so you would, short of getting a biopsy, you'd go after your quote-unquote asthmatic with a fixed obstruction on his spirometry?
There was 2 slides here which were missing in the presentation. Actually, when we do this smooth muscle markers, in the patient with fixed airway obstruction, you see this hypertrophy and this sort of bulk of smooth muscle. With patients with variable airway obstruction, those when they have sporadic smooth muscle. So I would go for the fixed airway. I would go for the fixed airway obstruction, at least if I don't have any other markers. They have better chance of responding to thermoplasty. Now, regarding your question whether we should go to the small airway, we would love to go to the small airway, but, you know, if you go to every single small airway, it would take 1 year to go to the airways. You know, the small airways, if you open them, it's like a whole telescope.
No, I'm just saying that's maybe why it didn't really show the benefit all across.
It could be, but also remember that the response here is only partial response. Those patients, they're showing decrease in exacerbations, but pulmonary function was not affected. And hyperresponsiveness was not affected. So I think there's still remnant. When you go to this treatment, you are only at the end stage of your options. And then when you will do it, the response is not dramatic in those patients. But what can we do?
So we're doing it late.
Yes.
Okay. I have a question for Dr. Sanil. Just to make it clear, you said, well, we should not do biopsy with Plavix. What's about aspirin and bronchoscopy? Because on the slides, we were a little bit confused with one of them.
Aspirin is perfectly safe. Okay. So that's what the data showed. That aspirin and transbronchial lung biopsies are safe. We do not have our patients stop aspirin at all in any of the bronchoscopies that we do, but we do stop all antiplatelet agents.
Good. How many days?
At least 5 to 7 days.
Okay. Dr. Kanish has a question on that, sure. I guess.
Thank you again. But I would like to ask Dr. Sonali about a little bit clarifying the issue of transbronchial biopsy on mechanical ventilation. I mean, what else would you do except than dropping P? I mean, can you elaborate on the techniques that you do? How do you do it? How do you ventilate? When do you take the biopsy? How do you coordinate with the patient? Do you sedate? Do you paralyze? I mean, this is a little bit serious for us because we still don't do it, but I would like to see how can we go through transbronchial under mechanical ventilation.
I agree. It is a serious topic. So we bring all the patients to our bronchoscopy suite. In my bronchoscopy suite, I have general anesthesia. The patient comes down intubated. This is not a procedure I would do in the ICU by any means. It might not be safe there. You might not be able to control bleeding if it happens. We bring them in a very controlled environment. I have a room with anesthesia in the room. They're already intubated. I want at least an 8.5 ET tube in. If the tube is not an 8.5, I have my anesthesiologist switch it out to an 8.5 ET tube, and that's because we use a therapeutic scope. The reason I use a therapeutic scope is it's easier for me to control bleeding. If there's bleeding and I need to put a bronchial blocker or something in, I have the ability to be able to do that. They do keep the patients on conventional ventilation. The PEEP is less than 5. The FiO2 generally we keep at 100% at that point. When we do transbronchial lung biopsies, for us, the technique that we find the best and what I teach my fellows is when you open your forceps, when you go out to the pleura and you pull back, you open your forceps. We open our forceps on inspiration and we advance on expiration, and then we close the forceps in expiration. That's how we feel that we get the best amount of tissue.
The yield, is it, we know that sometimes open lung biopsies don't give us a yield in, patients with diffuse lung disease or mechanical. So how about a transbronchial? This you mentioned at the end. Would you like to comment on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying that this is for every patient by any means. And the ICU calls me a lot, and I have to admit, I refuse more times than I accept to do the case because a lot of times when I think it's ARDS, I said, you know, I do question the physician asking, what is this going to change for you? Is this biopsy really going to make a difference? And if they convince me that it's something that absolutely they need and the patient's too sick to go, then we're willing to take the risk. If there are times that they call, and I actually do think that a VATS would be a better option because I think it's some kind of interstitial lung disease process going on and my transbronchial biopsy is going to be small, then I do recommend that we go to thoracic surgery. So I pick and choose my cases. I don't take every case by any means.
Dr. Sethi, I'm glad we have differences in the color of our hairs. We were trained in the days where in the 70s, and all the myths that you've mentioned, you are absolutely right for two reasons. And I'll tell you why the myths persist. It depends upon the experience of the bronchoscopist and the available ancillary services. If I need a thoracic surgeon because of tension pneumothorax or bleeding, I have to have him in the room, not to be called in. Absolutely. So these myths have to be considered, A, in the experience of the bronchoscopist, the availability of ancillary services, blood bank, and the rest. Sometimes even the presence of a cytologist in the room, as you know, also makes a big difference.
I absolutely agree
now,
with you.
Now, if you've had a bleeding of one carcinoid, in our days, we didn't know how to stop the bleeding. But one case is too many.
Absolutely.
And I tell you, maybe Dr. Kenj knows, we may have killed one or two patients inadvertently at that time. We didn't have the ancillary services. So I would caution to get rid of the myths until we have the backup service.
Right. So the purpose of my talk was not to make cowboys out of everyone and to go out and do all these things, and by no means am I advocating that. It was more to do a review of the literature of what we've had in the more recent times. Absolutely. And I have learned from all of you, and I do not diminish that by any means.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We will move to the next session. Okay.